All right, members and the audience, we've not had a quorum yet, but we're going to begin listening to Representative Ward's bill, and we'll call the meeting order and pass the minutes once things get started. So first up on the agenda is House File 116. Representative Ward, we can't move the bill yet, but we'll move it at the appropriate time, and please begin with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, today is one of those days that you will have an opportunity to make a real positive difference for our children in the state of Minnesota. Last session, legislation was passed which addressed safety issues surrounding Type 3 school vehicles and their drivers. It required drivers to comply with a number of requirements which came from the Office of the Legislative Auditor, including a physical and drug check. Previous authors of this bill, Representative Bigham and Senator Olsen, intended to exempt school employees who are temporary or incidental Type 3 drivers from the physical and drug testing requirements through language they referred to in the bill as, quote, normal duties. However, the term normal duties was interpreted by the Department of Public Safety differently than the legislative intent of the authors. The Department of Public Safety's interpretation requires school districts to have anyone who may possibly drive a Type 3 vehicle meet these requirements, even though regular school district employment may have met many of these requirements with the school districts. This placed a significant financial burden and hardship on many school districts in the form of an unfunded mandate in which they were having to decide do they need to cut extracurricular and co-curricular activities in order to meet this unfunded mandate. Members, House File 116 attempts to fix this problem while still protecting the safety of our children. I want to emphasize that. It will still protect the safety of our children. House File 116 will bring the law back its original intent by requiring that anyone who is employed for the sole purpose of driving a Type 3 vehicle must meet all of the requirements. Now, I can talk to members about the changes of the bill, but I will wait until questions. I have three testifiers today, Mr. Chair, that I would like to have come up and testify. And the first testifier is Allison Porter. She can introduce herself, who will share with you how this bill impacted her and her school.
Mr. Chairman, or Representative Ward, now that we have a quorum present, we'll call the meeting to order. And Representative Ward, or before we do that, we will, Representative Newton moves that the minutes from the meeting on March 4th be approved as written. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. And then we will, Representative Ward makes his motion to move House File 116 for possible inclusion in the K-12 finance omnibus bill. And welcome to our committee. Please state your name for the record so that 100 years from now, and they listen to the tape, they'll know who you are.
Well, the tape will be eroded by that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Allison Porter, and I appreciate you letting me testify on this important bill today. I'm also going to thank Representative Ward for letting me testify. I'm from Minnesota North Star Academy, and it's my third year there. And I want to talk to you today about how Type 3 driving requirements has impacted me and other students at North Star Academy. We have 35 high school students in total at my school, and in the past, when we had cooking and transition classes, the teachers could drive us to the grocery store or to where we needed to go. But now they can't. Now they also can't use the vans to drive us to games in other states so our team can play against other deaf teams. Now we have to rent a bus to drive us to our game or to go on field trips or to our transition classes or other school events. And I want you to know that I feel more safe when I have a driver who is deaf or who can communicate in sign language. Because if something happens, then they can communicate with us. If it's just a regular hearing person who doesn't use sign language, I can't communicate with them. Now, because of these new driving requirements, this means that our school is going to cancel field trips because all of our teachers are deaf. For example, we used to be able to go to the YMCA to practice because our gym only has a half court. So we'd go there so we could practice on a full court. But now we can't because our coaches are deaf. And so they can't drive us to the YMCA. And so that limits us to practice in the half court, and, you know, that doesn't give us enough practice. So it's really been hard on us, for the students, the coaches, teachers, parents, and it's really expensive for my school, you know, to pay drivers to get us to these places. And again, if they're hearing and they don't use sign language, then I really don't feel as safe with them. So I hope we will consider changing these Type 3 driving requirements so we can have our coaches and teachers drive us again. Thank you for your time and listening to my comments.
John, how do you say thank you in sign language?
Oh, that's wonderful.
Just like this.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ward, do you have two other testifiers?
Yes, I do have two other testifiers. If they'll come forward to give their testimony, I would appreciate it at this time. Dan Alfarger and Kirk Schneiderwin.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kirk Schneiderwin. I'm on staff of the School Board Association. I followed her at every committee hearing, and it's never an easy deal. It doesn't get any easier each time. She does a great job in testifying. And we just want to, with the School Board Association, we represent all public school districts, and this has been a contentious issue over the last year for a number of districts, and we've logged a ton of calls from school districts over this and trying to resolve this, and Representative Ward has been been a great advocate in trying to attempt to fix this, and we believe that the language in here provides the fix for school districts where it fixes those issues for the coaches, the debate coach, the academic decathlon coach who loads their 4 to 6 kids in the van or the SUV and drives to the neighboring town to compete. And so we know the districts were going different routes. I mean, we know districts didn't want to have to pay the physical examination and one other cost in there, and so they were trying to find, be creative in their approaches, and we believe this piece fixes it, and we certainly are going to support this language.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dan Alfarger, Education Minnesota. We'd like to thank Representative Ward for his work on this bill. This is an unintended consequence, or actually a different interpretation than all of the parties who had agreed to the bill believed it to be something that was workable and it needed to be fixed. And he's done a very fine job, including all the stakeholders, and so we're happy about the outcome. In addition to the coaches that have been mentioned, just think about this. How many school buildings are there in this state? And you would really need to have an individual go through and be approved to have these extra tests and these extra costs, because you will often have a child get sick during the middle of the day, let's say it's an elementary or even a high school student, and they need to get home, and their parents are at home, there's nobody to drive them, and how do they get home to school, how do they get from the school to home? There's little situations like that where the school needs to transport these kids. Now we have a way to get these kids and not have to have the extra expenses for the school, in addition to everything that the previous testifiers have said. Thank you.
Thank you. This is a public hearing, so are there any members in the gallery who wish to either testify for or against this legislation? Hi, please come up to the table and please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Marty Porter. I'm Allison's mom. From a parent's point of view, I just wanted to also express that we're incurring extra costs also. Excuse me. Having to take time off work to pick kids up. We have families that live an hour or two into Wisconsin that travel back and forth to pick up their kids every day. And now they're having to travel after a sports game to Elk River or Faribault. It's really putting a hardship on these people. Lastly, I'd like to say that as a hearing parent of a deaf child, I much prefer a deaf driver for my child. It's a lot safer and for communication purposes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any additional members of the public who wish to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, any questions from any committee members? Representative Detmer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Ward, I really thank you for bringing this forward, because I was just at a school function just the other night, and our athletic director came up to me and says, Representative Detmer, when are you going to be fixing this Type 3 school bus driver situation? So I'm glad that we've got it coming forward and that we can make the corrections that will help these schools out when it comes, especially for athletic events. And I know over the years, you know, I, the coach, or my assistant coaches, we would drive the vans and take care of things. It would be a lot cheaper than taking a bus. So it's a good thing that we're correcting this. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Detmer as well, committee members. I would be shocked if all the members had not heard from at least one of their school districts about this Type 3 bill, especially Greater Minnesota, but it doesn't matter. It's a bill that affects all of us and all of our school districts and all of our children. And as Representative Detmer said so well, it's a financial situation, too, where we can significantly help our children in our districts and maintain and retain co-curricular and extracurricular activities by just making this a little bit of a change. And there's other organizations that I want you to know to support this. I won't go through all of them, but there's a large number of people that support this bill. So thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions at this point, but thank you for your consideration for this bill.
Thank you, Representative Ward. Seeing no other questions from members, Representative Ward renews his motion to have House File 116 laid over for possible inclusion in the K-12 finance bill. Thank you.
Thank you, members.
Representative Mariani. Representative Mariani moves that House File 314 be laid over for possible inclusion in the K-12 finance bill. Representative Mariani, see your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, this bill, let me get my notes together here. All right, this bill, House File 314, passed out of the Policy Committee recently. And so I've got a couple of testifiers. I know that a number of the members here don't serve on K-12 policy, so I think it's absolutely appropriate to talk about the policy implications, but obviously as a finance committee, you'll be particularly interested in considering the fiscal impacts of the bill. The bill essentially changes the dropout age. We currently, it came as a surprise to me when I first learned of it a year or two ago. Or we focused on it that Minnesota has a age 16 dropout age. This bill would change that to age 18. There is a fiscal cost that brings. The bill is structured in such a way so that its effective date is meant to occur not in the coming biennium, but in the following biennium. And so the fiscal note is shown out in the tails of the year 2013, it's a $341,000 fiscal tail. It assumes not that every student that's enrolled would be and that drops out, I didn't phrase that right, but it does not assume that every student that's currently enrolled will continue to be enrolled, but it does assume that those students that are currently going through the process, or the type of students that are going through the process of actually notifying the schools, would subsequently be convinced mandated and convinced that they should stay in school. And so the numbers don't reflect the cost of every student currently in the system. Really reflects those students that we assume are most likely to be heavily influenced to remain within the system. Minnesota sets, as I said, the upper compulsory age at 16. There are 20 other states that set the upper compulsory age at 18, and one of our neighbor states, Iowa, recently in their House of Representatives, moved passed the bill out of their body to move to 18. Wisconsin and South Dakota, two other neighboring states, currently are at 18. There are eight states that set it at 17, and then there are two states, and I believe the District of Columbia is really the other, so one other state, and I think D.C., that allows education agencies to set the upper compulsory age, so it's done at a local level. By now, most of you, I'm sure, know the connection between education and economic and social success. We know from studies done by the Education Commission of the state that one could expect to have wages that are $10,000 more a year for a high school graduate as opposed to a high school dropout. We also know that the mean annual income rises with increasing post-secondary educational credentials. And of course, you know, you can't get to post-secondary unless you go through the doorway of a diploma. There are also strong social indicators that are tied to earning a high school diploma. So you can infer by these indicators of the impact of a high school diploma. We know, for instance, that again from ECS, that dropouts are disproportionately represented in our prison system. I think ECS cites figures as high as 70%. And we also know that there are reported higher health problems among this community of cohort of students, with 30% of those currently struggling and having to access welfare assistance being high school dropouts. This state, I'm not assuming that we have not discouraged students from dropping out. Our school districts certainly work awfully hard to do that. They work hard hand in hand with our county attorneys through truancy laws to discourage dropping out at all, much less dropping out at 16. However, I think the time is upon us where we really need to add another tool to the toolbox here in recognition of the perhaps, well, not perhaps, the even more important relevancy of a high school diploma relative to both economic and social well-being, not only of our state, but also of individuals. You all know that there's big demographic shifts that are happening in our state, and without getting into the details, it basically means that now more than ever before, every student in our K-12 system is just that much more important to our well-being. We really don't have bodies to spare, if you will, anymore. And so I think it's really incumbent on us to really maximize the educational outcomes of all our K-12 students. This bill does not address what will most certainly be needed in order for school districts to create the kind of relevant, powerfully relevant learning environment that can overcome whatever's happening in a young person's life that would lead them to drop out. I think you'll hear shortly from our testifiers that school districts are committed to ever creating more creative and powerful ways to bring that kind of relevancy so that we can not only have the hammer over students, though that's important, but also have a strong inducement for them to stay in school. So members, with that, I'll stop. Basically, it's my belief that our bar is set too low at age 16. What that basically means is that when you're 14 or 15, you can already start, realistically thinking about, ending your K-12 experience. I think it's time for us to send a much more stronger message to our young and to our society in this regard. And Mr. Chair, I do have I'll grab in a second. I've got a letter from my Ramsey County attorney. I want to have that passed around to committee members, but I'd ask my testifiers to come forward and just very briefly and quickly share with you why they think this is an important policy initiative on our part.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. And Representative Mariani, there's a couple of members who have questions. Do you prefer to have those questions wait until after your testifiers have gone, or do you prefer to take the question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yes, I would prefer.
Very good. Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the state.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michelle Walker, and I am the Chief Accountability Officer at St. Paul Public Schools. I'm pleased to be here today to encourage you to extend the mandatory school attendance age from age 16 to 18. Our superintendent, Dr. Maria Karsarfin, has testified before other committees of the House and the Senate on this issue, and I want to underscore some of the information that has been previously highlighted. As many of you know, our district serves a very diverse population, reflecting more than 70 languages and dialects. And on a daily basis, we have over 38,000 students who arrive at our 65 schools with an array of educational experiences and skills. Regardless of how our students come to our schools and their level of preparedness, our job is to raise expectations and to educate all of them for success. We want to encourage, and we do encourage, all of our students to graduate to great things. So to that end, I ask that you change the Minnesota's current mandatory school attendance age from 16 to 18. We as a community have to get serious about high school completion, and we have to remove the barriers that get in the way, such as policies that really were designed ages ago and are not suitable for the education environment that we're in today. The question is, how can we expect our students to graduate to high standards when we do not expect them to stay in school through the typical graduation age? I'm a data person in our district, and so I just want to share some of the data from St. Paul Public Schools, Minnesota, and the United States to kind of highlight the urgency of this issue. For us in St. Paul Public Schools, our most recent data shows, as of 2008, that 62% of our students graduate within 4 years. 22% of them continue high school, and about 11% of them drop out. And over a two-year period of time, from the fall of 2006 to the spring of 2008, we had 465 students between the ages of 16 and 17 who left our district for a number of reasons. And of that 465 16 and 17-year-olds, we were able to confirm through our contact with either the students themselves or their parents that 101 of those students had decided to drop out of our system and would not be returning to school. However, I will say that few of them actually went through the formal process of coming in and saying that they were legally dropping out. But through our contact with the students, we do know that a good number of them have made the decision not to return to school. With respect to our graduation rates, we also have disparities among our student groups. We have only 61% of our American Indian students graduating, 64% of our Latino students, and 76% of our Black students graduating from St. Paul Public Schools. And that's when you look at the NCLB graduation rate. If we looked at our internal four-year graduation rate, those numbers would be even smaller. So we really must free up our schools to do what they do best, and that's educate our students. And as Representative Mariani explained, our state is one of 20 states that still allow this low mandatory attendance age. Our students know that the current law is on their side when it comes to dropping out. In the United States, we see statistics that mirror what we're seeing in our district. More than half of African American and Latino students graduate from high school on time, and only 12 to 14% of them graduate having met the requirements to attend a state university. We know that those students who do not graduate from high school face a lifetime of disadvantage, earning an average of close to $10,000 less per year than students who graduate from high school, and more than $1 million less than college graduates for their lifetime. According to the Alliance for Excellent Education, every year 14,900 students in Minnesota do not graduate with their peers. The lost lifetime earnings in Minnesota for that class of dropouts alone totals nearly $4 billion. Minnesota would save more than $224 million in health care costs over the course of lifetimes of each class of dropouts had they earned diplomas. Households would have over $829 million more in accumulated wealth if all heads of households had graduated from high school. More than $1.3 billion would be added to Minnesota's economy by 2020 if students of color graduated at the same rate as white students. If Minnesota's high schools graduated all students ready for college, the state would save more than $89 million a year in community college remediation courses and lost earnings. and Minnesota's economy would see a combination of savings and revenue of more than $77 million in reduced crime spending and increased earnings each year if the male high school graduation rate increased just by 5%. Now, we in St. Paul Public Schools and many of our neighboring school districts and partners have made various efforts to extend time before and after school within our traditional environments, and even to create alternative options and paths and to support students who may not complete within the regular time. But their efforts to continue their education needs to be supported by a legal and policy environment that's not prohibitive, and that does not make their efforts the exception as opposed to the rule. We all know that when students drop out, everyone loses, not just the students, but families, taxpayers, and residents. This really is more than just about education, and we get that that's our job, but this is about the quality of life for students who drop out and for the communities in which they live. We thank you very much for your interest in this issue and for your commitment to the children of our state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Mariani, and members of the committee. My name is Robert McCauley, and I am the retired Associate Superintendent for High Schools in Minneapolis Public Schools and currently Interim Principal at Patrick Henry High School in Minneapolis. And I'm here today to speak in favor of House File 314, the Act to Increase the Age of Compulsory Attendance to Age 18. I want to thank you, Representative Mariani, for bringing the bill forward. I will not bring as much data and statistics. I think it was well presented. Thank you very much. That is exactly the kind of information that we need in front of this committee. But we are encouraging to enact this bill to increase the compulsory attendance age to 18 because it supports the mission of schools across all of Minnesota, but especially for us in Minneapolis, where we are trying to ensure that all our students are learning to high expectations and standards and will graduate from high school with our mission being that they will be ready for college and work and careers. And while we know that the proposal is not a silver bullet solution, as there are many other key strategies that must be in place to support student retention and to bring students forward to graduation, it's a critical strategy that does help us constructively re-engage students and retain students in high school and to keep them there. And as has been stated with some very solid data, that we know that high school completion is the minimum entry requirement for college and higher education and ultimately well-paid employment. We know the consequences of not finishing high school. It's very clear. For our economy to recover from where we are now, we need to increase the quality and the quantity of our graduates. We know that an educated workforce has to be viewed as the best way to stimulate the economy and to grow jobs. Our global economy is going to demand a highly trained and diverse workforce, and we have the diversity right here in these cities that we need and want. We need them to graduate from high school. We need them to continue in their education. We also know that, as was expressed earlier, the more time students are in school, the more that students finish in school, the fewer students are engaged in risky behaviors. And risky behaviors encompass quite a wide range, but we do know that as we provide support services, et cetera, to students in our schools, that we are trying to help them to develop, grow, and become productive citizens. We also know that more students of African-American, Hispanic, Latino, and American Indian backgrounds drop out than any other groups, and that they subsequently have lower overall achievement. We're trying to keep them in school with a series of strategies. We think this policy is another policy that will strengthen us keeping them in school so that we can provide them with the skills, the tools, the education that's necessary for them to compete later in life. We also believe strongly that many students at age 16 are still too immature or just don't fully understand the consequences of dropping out of school at an early age. That many times these students return later when they're 18, 19, or even in their 20s, wishing they had made another choice. I can tell you the personal story of student after student after student having spent something like 19 years in high school, and a young man that I talked with just this past summer, who came back to finish the last reading test that he had to pass in order to graduate at age 22. So that he could go into school. And he said, I wish I had tried harder and done better and not left school at age 17. It's not until later that they really see the consequences of their leaving school. If you have an opportunity, if you ever have an opportunity to attend an adult basic education class, for example, you will hear the personal stories of these students over and over again, and many languages often. And, of course, raising the age to 18 sends a very strong message that we in the state, we in the schools, we as parents, we in the communities are very serious about schooling in Minnesota, and that a high school diploma does mean something, that it's not just a meaningless piece of paper. Raising the age to 18 gives every student the same expectation of graduation, regardless of their circumstances, and we're setting the bar higher as we prepare all kids to be college and workforce ready. Raising the age to 18 also increases the opportunities for schooling necessary for our English language learners, many of whom are in our schools and take longer than 4 years, but often work very hard to complete high school requirements so that they can achieve at higher academic levels, as well as continue to command the English language. And I guess the last rationale I've presented is for no other reason. Our children deserve a society in which the adults are willing to stand up and not let the children decide what's best for them when they want to make bad choices. And I think of my own 18-year-old when I think of that, but when we want to make bad choices, and that we set clear and high expectations for them and say no to failure. And I appreciate your support for this measure, the work that we do, and the success of all of our students. And I have a handout available that shows the graduation rates that have increased in Minneapolis over the years. I said I retired, but I still followed with great interest. We began the effort at reform, and so I would pass those out for you to show that while we are asking for an increase to age 18, we began a number of years ago to improve the graduation rates and to reduce the dropout rates and to improve student achievement across the board. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Doctor. And Representative Mariani, do you have any other testifiers?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't.
Okay, thank you. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if the Chair will indulge, I have a few questions. The first will be very specific to the policy, the financial implications of the bill, but then I do have a few questions of the author on the policy implications as well. Now, I'm going to start off by saying the statements made by the author and by the testifier as to the value of education, they're givens, and everyone here believes that, inarguably. And that's important. So questioning this bill, all right, and questioning the necessity for this bill by no means implies that any legislator who does so questions the value of an education. And I think that's that needs to be put out there because it would appear by the testimony that we have to vote for this, otherwise we don't see a value in education, and I think that's a false premise. Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Crow can help me understand the fiscal note that we have in front of us, because as I look at the fiscal note on page 2, where we start the discussion and assumptions, I see in row B that the count of age 16 to 18-year-old dropouts in FY09 is set aside as 99, and by FY13 it's down to 93, yet according to the testimony, I heard 14,500 students don't graduate with their class. So I'm not, I guess, Mr. Crow, can you help me understand the assumption that's being made here?
Mr. Crow or Mr. Strong?
Mr. Chair, Representative Fiskin, I believe the assumption that the department is making in the fiscal note is that a number of the students who are dropping out are not going to be affected by a law requiring them to stay in school until they're 18. So in other words, the change of the law alone is not enough to change the student's behavior, and that's why there's a relatively low number of students that are expected to stay in school because of the law change.
If I can clarify, because I want to make sure that that's understood. I believe the assumption is that there are some students that are not going to be affected. And obviously it assumes that some others will. And so I just want to make sure, I'm not saying you didn't say that, Mr. Chairman, but I want to make sure that the impression here is that no one's going to be influenced by this position.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mariani, let me also add that the numbers of dropouts, of course, is a different measure depending on if they re-enroll or not. But in terms of the fiscal note, the reason why there's a lower number on the fiscal note than one would expect is because they're figuring in some behavioral effects as to what the law change will actually mean.
Representative Biscombe.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, according to the department, the behavioral effects would be on about a total of 99 students statewide in FY09. And I know this doesn't go into effect until far later than that, but even by the time it does go into effect, the number of students that this law change would affect is down to 93. I also have another question. Representative Mariani, and again, this does go to the fiscal note, Representative Mariani, what is the remedy for the public school if a student who is now bound by compulsory attendance between ages, after age 16 up to age 18, if the student doesn't comply? How do we force compliance?
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biscombe, you're asking forcing compliance for those up to the age of 16,
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Mariani, no, I'm asking, how do we force compliance up to the age of 18? What is the remedy for the school to get the kids back into school? What is the lever that schools have besides pointing to a line in a red book, a 3-inch red book, and saying right there, you have to? What do schools do? What can
If I understand your question correctly, there are truancy laws that this triggers. And one of the things that, and you'll see it demonstrated written in the letter from our friends, the county attorney, is that you'll have county attorney offices that have developed under guidance of the law, hopefully effective strategies where they use the hammer of the law, but also provide some intervention, almost like counseling and guidance, but using the law as an ability to do that. Other than that, I think you really are then left to the ability of our school districts to create perhaps a different and more enticing, if you will, environment for students so that they can then elect. Once they've been, shaken, by the use of the law, to be able to encourage them that, in fact, there's a different experience that they could have in our K-12 schools. But that also goes to the issue of each district designing those kind of creative interventions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair, Mr. Crow, and Chair Mariani. I guess that's the second part then in my fiscal note concern, is that the fiscal note did not factor in any additional cost to the courts that would be incurred through having to enforce the higher compulsory attendance policy. So I just throw that out there. Mr. Chair,
if I can respond to that quickly, although it's not within the purview of this committee, would certainly be in the purview of Representative Paymar's committee, but the testimony we received in our committee from our county attorney is that, and of course it's not a fiscal note, so this is her sort of gut call, is that they think it'd be a wash. So essentially, they're already geared up, they're already structured to be able to meet the truancy laws, to carry out those expectations, and that they would therefore then continue to direct those resources and those staff to be able to do it at age 18 as opposed to age 16.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. May I appreciate the indulgence of Chair Grosso and Chair Mariani to the policy issues, and this is a policy concern, and I don't get a chance to sit on the policy committee. I'll throw these out there, and then if Chair Mariani wants to respond, that'd be great. The first thing is, and I know Chair Mariani, I did have a chance to listen to your committee. Believe it or not, at 8:30 in the morning, I do sometimes for the House audio committee room audio is a great tool, and I do get to follow a lot of your committee because it is something I'm passionate about. But I know you spent quite a bit of time in committee on the Achieve report and on looking at why kids drop out, I think by far and away it was because schools were not relevant to kids. I think that was 47% of the responses on why kids drop out. One of the an incredible motivator, believe it or not, for the human being and for systems is financial. For schools currently to retain these students who are 16 to 18 years old, or 17 and 18 basically, if they're going to retain them and retain the funding with our current setup, they have to resolve. They have to look at what they are doing with these kids and how they can make school more meaningful and relevant to these children. And Chair Mariani, I know you agree with that fundamental premise. Right? And yet, we are through this legislation, we're removing a huge motivator for a system that's very reluctant to change in the first place, right, from changing, right, by now compelling the students to stay in school versus the more altruistic. Students are there because they want to be there. Right? So if you could respond to that, and then I have one more. Well, Representative Diskins, if I let you talk anymore, I don't think they're going to let me chair this committee ever again. So, Representative Mariani.
If I may, Representative, again, this is Michelle Walker from St. Paul Public Schools. I do think that you're right on that one of the primary reasons, one of the reasons for students dropping out is the level of engagement in our schools. There are other factors, which I think you alluded to, financial, in that many of our students are breadwinners themselves in their families and have to contribute to that. And the other piece is, I think, to some degree, a reflection of our communities that they may not see opportunities, post-secondary opportunities as a reality for them. All of those things intersect in the school system in terms of how we engage our students. And what I would say is that I don't think that this particular legislation will remove our responsibility as a school district to create more engaging school environments, to look at alternative ways of providing instruction. I would say that if we taught high school exactly the same way as any of us in the room experienced high school today, that probably would not be very meaningful. It probably wouldn't be very meaningful to me to go back into my high school that I went into decades ago. So I do think that we have that responsibility. We are not shirking that responsibility at all. And I think that this legislation would actually be a support and companion to that effort and not a pass, so to speak. I think it's a number of things. My colleague here said that this piece of legislation is not the silver bullet. It's certainly not the only solution. It needs to be accompanied by many solutions, starting, of course, with the school system and what we do on an instructional basis and how we partner with our universities and businesses to make those experiences really meaningful and not just college preparatory, but also career preparatory for our students. So I would say that, I see this as a support and certainly not a pass.
Representative Diskins, very briefly, because we do have other members who want to have questions.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
You bet.
The final point I have, and I think this is probably the most bothersome piece of policy change that I have in here. Now, two statements that were made by the testifiers. First was a statement that we do not expect students to stay in school under current law. I think that's a false premise. I think we do expect them to stay till graduation age. We just don't compel them to stay till graduation age. And then another statement was the statement that many times too few 16-year-olds are too immature to make that decision. And I would concur. Right? However, right, as you look at current law, what you are repealing for current law, right, is the parents' ability to make that decision. Right? See, right now, a student can't legally drop out of school unless the parents sign off. So we're not actually thwarting the will of the student by this change, we're thwarting the will of their parents. And I think that's a huge difference. What we are saying is that we as a governmental body know better for an individual child than the parent or guardian of that child. And to me, that's the most troublesome piece of this legislation.
Representative Swell.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Mariani, one of the things, and I guess Representative Vistens was alluding to this, I'm a classroom teacher, and I know, and I support this bill wholeheartedly, but if you set the expectations high, students will meet them. I do think the first couple of years, maybe up to 4 years, this is going to be kind of a rocky policy change in terms of getting students to recognize that it's a cultural shift in our state. And you talked about having more engaging things in the classroom, but I also know that a lot of the students who drop out because of maybe emotional problems or crime or whatever. So I appreciate the fact that this is, you know, there are trade-offs. You know, I'm sure the county attorneys are saying, great, now we're just going to worry about truancy and not vandalism and things like that. But what kind of provisions are the schools thinking about for alternative learning centers, for more technical classes, more, you know, vocational skill classes? Because I think if you're going to make this shift, then it's a cultural shift that's also going to require some sort of an incentive or enticement for the students to want to be there.
Representative Mariani.
This is Dr. McCauley again, and I agree it is a shift. I have a number of things I'd like to say in terms of some of the questions that have come up, but first of all, I think that I look at high schools across Minnesota, but also in the Twin Cities especially, as having been engaged in some restructuring and changes. We now have Project Lead the Way in engineering classes in high schools. We are reaching down into the middle schools to extend that and bring that up. We've worked on changing programs so that they are more relevant, and relevant in the sense that they're engaging. They admit, when people talk about relevance, the thing I always have to add to that, besides engagement, is personal connection. Mm-hmm. Often the student is the troubled young person for many reasons, whether it be economical, social, cultural, personal, whatever, that is looking for someone to listen, to someone help them, guide them, to help bring them through this process of education that we're working at. Because kids do see relevance in some very personal ways. It's not just one standard kind of thing. And that connection has to happen in smaller units by changing the shopping mall high school, as it used to be called, to breaking it down where we have people who are teens and working with kids. And that is a culture shift for high schools. High schools have been the dinosaurs of education for years, and I know that because I've participated, and I own that. What the changes are, of course, is that we're now looking at how can we teach teachers to bring quality into their work, to bring those personal connections that are the kinds of counseling that bring youngsters along developmentally, educationally, build them up so that they can see themselves. So much of the work we do in high school is around knowledge, learning, high expectations, and confidence in that, developing that. We do not look at this bill as saying, okay, we're about to lose this large group of kids, so you have to sort of hold them there for us. We know what our work is. We know where we have to go. And what I would suggest is that this is but a piece that says, students, families, this is an expectation we hold for you. The fact that the law says, in my mind, my experience, is that I have seen very few families come forward and pull a kid out of high school. I have seen kids walk away, and they're gone. And then we have to try to find them, and we don't have that. We don't have that wherewithal or that kind of connection out there. So the work here is to say, here are the expectations. Now we do want to work with families keeping youngsters in school, and we want to increase our standards. Youngsters who leave high school before they are finished are on a path that is not leading towards success of much of any kind. And we can all tell the individual story about the, you know, the very bright guy who went off and started Microsoft or something, but that individual research does not prove the main point.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to follow on, actually, some of the questions Mr. Representative Diskins asked, is I would first seriously question the fiscal note, because it seems to me that if we've got some 1,400, is that the number that's used, of kids dropping out each year, and we only anticipate getting 100 back in school, that seems awfully small. The other thing is, I think we're creating another unfunded mandate for both our county attorneys and law enforcement people. We're telling them they're going to have to go out and chase after kids when they're already overloaded. And my list, Representative Diskins, is probably as long as yours, and I'll try to keep it short here. But we have quite a few kids in confinement, ages 16 to 18. Those kids now will have to be back in school and have to have teachers assigned to them, and that's one of the things I questioned with the fiscal note as well. We'll have to be providing education for them while they're in confinement. You mentioned that before the kids graduating, before they finish, or dropping out before they finish high school, but by our requiring them to stay in high school isn't a guarantee that they're going to graduate. And if you have kids who are not happy in high school and are leaving for reasons that they just feel school isn't relevant, that's no guarantee that they're going to graduate if they stay two more years. And with that, I'll leave it with that.
Press, you have another bill, I believe, and I think it's important for us to be very, very brief.
I just wanted to clarify the record with some of the numbers that I provided. The 14,000 number that you heard was students who do not graduate with their peers. So that doesn't mean that they automatically drop out. They may graduate in 5 years or 6 years. And for the numbers that I provided for St. Paul about students who drop out of our system, the way that our system is coded is that a student who leaves for any reason is dropped out until we actually know the reason. And so that's why I mentioned that the 101 students were those that we formally called, and many that they were not deciding to return to school. So I just wanted to make sure that those numbers were clear, because they have come up a few times.
Thank you. Representative Depke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was very happy to have Chairman Carlos Mariani bring forward this bill again, because we heard it in the policy, education policy, and my school districts are firmly and believe that this is a very good bill. My concerns, however, are fiscal, as Representative Diskins were. And having just come off of a education unfunded mandate, I also am concerned with extra costs, and I do am concerned about the fiscal note of only $341,000. I think in addition to the extra teachers, we have to look at, for our schools, the additional space and materials needed. We talked about the truancy enforcement, which appears in the courts to be a wash, but how about the extra counseling or disciplinary costs that might be required in the schools? Finally, the alternative learning centers. I know that Representative Mariani did say in our policy committee that that certainly would be an opportunity for these students, but I think that we have to make sure that the expansion in the ALC programs comes within under their purview, and we need to know what those costs are as well. So I just wanted to let you know that.
Thank you. This is a public hearing. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Mariani, do you have any closing comments?
Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate the discussion here. Obviously, an important policy issue. The committee, of course, has the responsibility to look at fiscal notes and engage with the department in that respect. But by and large, we pretty much follow the guidance of whoever prepares the fiscal notes. I know that there's a cost either way. We're not in an age where we're looking to add costs because of the economic situation. And so Representative Biskins is correct that none of this should infer that we don't care about students who are 17 to 18. There's no one on this in this room who voted for the age 16. I mean, that's been there for a long time. I suspect not. And so I think what we're dealing with is sort of, you know, an adjustment in time as our society moves forward, and I think it's time for us to move forward with an age 18 expectation. I appreciate the your indulgence, and I renew my motion that this bill be recommended to pass and waive over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Mariani, how about we just lay it over for possible inclusion in the case?
Thank you,
Representative Mariani.
Thank you so much.
Next is House File 439. Representative Norton. Representative Detmer moves that House File 439 be considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus case for finance bill.
Yes, I do.
Representative Norton.
I'm back again, Mr. Chair.
Hopefully this bill's better than the last one you had before us, huh?
That passed handedly, so that would be fine.
Representative Norton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We're very pleased today to bring forward bipartisanly this important issue for your consideration this afternoon. In my many years as a child advocate in the areas of education and children's health, I've spent countless hours on issues improving academic outcomes, reducing childhood obesity and improving vending and nutrition options for children in our schools, and improving levels of physical activity in our youth, which is why I'm excited to bring this to you today. We've made great progress in many of those areas, but there's one area that we've actually taken a step backwards in, and that would be the area of physical education standards and expectations in our schools. I'm going to briefly touch on the components of the bill, and then I would like to hand the mic over to my where is he? They're right over here. My co-author on the bill, and then some testifiers who I believe you recognize, Mr. Chair.
Maybe.
Yeah. The first of the components is going to require standards. We are one of only three states that do not currently have statewide standards for physical education. This bill moves us from locally identified standards to allowing districts to choose between either the QTN or the NASPE, National Standards for Physical Education. Studies show that increasing physical fitness is associated with higher levels of achievement and reduced obesity as those children become adults. The second component is that it sets a 0.5 graduation requirement for physical education for our high school students. It would set a graduation requirement similar to reading, social studies, science, and math. When available, we are also asking that districts publish their wellness policy on the school website. There are no costs to the state with this bill, and for a vast majority of school districts in our state, the bill simply will support their efforts and ensure that physical education continues to be a part of a comprehensive education that we all, I know, value for our children. Passage of statewide standards has the possibility of availing our school districts to some federal grant dollars, called PEP grants, and we can talk about those later if you want to know a little bit more. And it also dovetails nicely with the 2008 healthcare reform SHIP, which is statewide health improvement plan dollars and grants that school districts can use to address obesity, which also might include physical education in our schools. In K-12 policy, a couple weeks ago, we had some testimony from Dr. Rady, and some of you are on both committees, so you heard those. that information. But just for those of you that were not, what Dr. Rady showed and demonstrated is that there's plenty of data that shows that physical education does improve academic outcomes for our children. It's also always been my belief that our schools, when acting in local apprentice for our children, should be role models of academic, social, and nutritional standards, and this bill supports that belief. I want to remind the committee that this bill passed the House last session and was in the education policy omnibus bill, but unfortunately that fell vetoed to the governor's pen, but that was not the cause of the veto, and so we're hoping we will support it again this year, and I would like to hand the microphone over to Representative Detmer.
Yeah, just very quickly, Mr. Chairman and committee members, as I pointed out, you know, before, if you were at the policy hearing last week, you know, the state standards were basically covered the five components of fitness in terms of muscular strength and also the muscular endurance, cardiovascular endurance, and also flexibility and body composition. Those are five areas, five components that need to be part of a physical fitness program. And as pointed out last week also, the benefits of exercise in terms of the research is showing that it has, just even moderate exercise will have effect on the brain's performance. And in terms of reducing stress and improving ability to learn. And I think, I know 4 or 5 days a week before coming down here, I do have an exercise program and it really helps, I tell you that. Reducing anxiety and also eliminating the drug problem that we have in our schools. And also the mood swings. The research shows that exercise will help prevent mood swings and also help our ability to focus on what we're doing. And for students in school, in terms of the learning process, experts show that exercising in the morning is the best time to exercise. So I'll quit with that.
Representative Norton, we have the information I have was 4 testifiers, so I'm going to let you manage your time for your presentation, but if you have a fewer number, it's up to you. But
I have 2 here with me today, and I would assume there may be at least 1 testifying against, but I have 2 today.
Okay.
That I'm aware of.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Oh, I'm sorry. 3. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Please state your name for the record, and feel free to talk about what a great guy your state rep is. I'm just kidding. You don't need to. You don't know.
How much time do we have for that?
Not enough, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and remember, you're not under oath.
Please, go ahead. My name is Jack Alwell. I'm a physical education teacher at Northdale Elementary School in Farmington and have been in the district for 31 years, so have a little bit of a track record in this field. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the levity before we're getting started. But a number of years ago, the National Commission on Education Excellence issued a report entitled A Nation at Risk, which gave our school systems a failing grade. We are at risk today because we've become a nation at rest. We are, and I don't believe it's coincidental that our sedentary lifestyle and the ills that accompany it began to accelerate as schools across the country began dropping PE requirements in favor of more seat time. There is mounting research that shows replacing seat time with seat time actually improves both the fitness of the student and their brain function as well. And as Representative Detmer mentioned, it also affects adults. So I want to let everybody know that as well. I'm testifying in favor of the passage of this bill in the hopes that it will be the first of many steps in the reestablishment of physical education in our schools. PE's reinstatement is vital not just to our students' current and future health, but also to their academic performance as well, as we'll see here in a few moments. You may recall a national ad campaign for a particular oil filter wasn't too long ago. A mechanic looks up from the middle of a costly engine overhaul and says, "You can pay me now or you can pay me later." These sobering words may well describe the choice we are now facing with today's obesity crisis, brought upon largely by our sedentary lifestyle. Childhood overweight and obesity have risen alarmingly over the last couple decades, and with it the health care costs spiraling out of control. Research has shown that upwards of 80% of the children between age 10 and 13 that are overweight or obese will remain so through the duration of their lives, and the number goes up as they approach the age of 18. Clearly, the time to intervene is in childhood. Quality physical education programs like the one in Naperville, Illinois, have been shown to be an effective intervention in what might seem to be an unstoppable process. Only 3% of incoming ninth graders at Naperville are overweight, where they have middle school everyday physical education. You compare this with the state of California's ninth grade classes, which tip the scales at better than 30% are overweight. Illinois, by the way, mandates physical education daily, where California does not. This is important in the academic arena as well. The more fit a student is, the greater the achievement on standardized tests. In a landmark study by the state of California, and they've repeated this study every other year, nearly 1 million 5th, 7th, and 9th graders results on the Fitness Gram fitness test, which Representative Detmer referred to moments ago, were compared with the Stanford achievement test scores. There was a direct positive correlation between the degree of fitness and the test scores. In findings later to be published later this year by Dr. Kenneth Cooper of Dallas, he found the same relationship with 2.6 million Texas students. Two University of Illinois researchers, Charles Hillman and Darla Castelli, in 2007 replicated the CDE results that found two fitness indices that related most directly to academic performance. Aerobic capacity related positively to reading and math scores, whereas body mass index, I think you can think waist size on that, related inversely, and these results held regardless of gender or socioeconomic status. The importance of well-intentioned, directed, vigorous activity cannot be overstated. Consider Anthony Elementary in Leavenworth, Kansas, ranked 9th in math and 10th and dead last in its district in reading, and desperate for improvement, it tried a bold move. It instituted for the first time a daily physical activity program while improving school nutrition. After 1 year, Anthony was ranked 1st in math and 2nd in reading. Not surprisingly, the number of students qualifying for National Fitness Awards rose by 1,300%. Not lost on the school counselor was also a reduction in office referrals for discipline from 438 to 18 in a single year. Even more daring was Titusville, Pennsylvania, a decaying steel town, where 75% of its students are on free or reduced lunches. They lengthened the school day and reduced academic time to make room for everyday physical education at the secondary level. In 1 year, they went from below state standard in averages in reading and math to plus 17 and 18%, and also experienced a significant drop in behavioral disruptions. And there have been results of this nature in our own backyard as well. At North Trail Elementary in Farmington, the last 3 years, we've conducted an early morning class for struggling readers with remarkable success. The class met for 15 minutes just before the students' regularly scheduled reading classes, which they joined in progress. Each session consisted of vigorous games and activities with embedded reading components. Students improved at nearly 5 times the national norm, 3 times more quickly than their peers, and nearly twice as quickly as the Title I students in our district. And the average increase in grade level reading in one quarter over the winter quarter was 1.25 grade levels. These gains have remained constant each of the 3 years that we've conducted the class. The class is voluntary, but students at North Trail already enjoy physical education on a daily basis, while other schools in our district meet only twice weekly. That too has yielded academic rewards. North Trail students report the highest test scores in the district at all grade levels, that's 2nd through 5th grade, in both reading and math, although we do not start the year testing at the highest levels in the district. So perhaps the Surgeon General had Benjamin Franklin's proverb, "An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure," in mind when he said this: "School-based interventions have been shown to be successful in increasing physical activity levels. With evidence that success in this arena is possible," he said, "every effort should be made to encourage students to require daily physical education in each grade and promote physical activities that can be enjoyed through the rest of their lives." Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Doctor. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Chairman Grasslow. Stephen Geis, I'm principal at North Trail Elementary. Prior to that, I was principal at a secondary building, Farmington Middle School West, where I had 8th and 9th graders, if you can imagine having 1,000 students of that grade combination. I'm here in support of the bill also because I've seen the positive effects. As a secondary principal, we had students taking PE. We had four full-time PE instructors, and we saw the number of referrals to the office go down, and we saw attendance increase. And then switching to the elementary 4 years ago, Mr. Alwell came to me and he said, "Stephen, can you imagine a building where everyone's reading at their reading rate, at their literacy level where they should be at?" And I said, "Tell me more." And he started doing research on Naperville, and I went there in the spring of 07, to see what was going on and to meet with Phil Lawler, and just to see the magic that was taking place. And I knew it was happening in North Trail because I know the test scores. Drilled down into it, and one of the reasons why is because the students have the opportunity to have that physical education every day. Jack has proven it, and it's provided miracles for our students. The ones that weren't reading at grade level and that are up and at it, and then just the excitement in the building that students want to go to that class. The other students that aren't in it in the morning, they want to figure out a way to get in it. However, we're discouraging that because we want them to go. I'm going to keep this short because the last time that I was here before the other committee, there wasn't any time for questions and answers, so I'd like to leave time for that. So I appreciate your time and your support in favor of this making it a standard.
Thank you, Doctor. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dr. Mark Manley. I'm the Vice President and Medical Director of Population Health at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, and I lead our Center for Prevention. And prior to coming here, I worked on prevention at the National Institutes of Health for a number of years. I'm speaking on behalf of Blue Cross today, though, about creating statewide standards for physical education. Blue Cross supports this bill because reducing the rates of obesity is one of our major corporate goals. And we support it because the Centers for Disease Control has recommended creating physical activity standards as a proven strategy to increase physical activity and to help control obesity. I'm going to share a little bit of information about the economic case for passing this law. It is Blue Cross's mission to help reduce disease by addressing some of the root causes of disease, and one of our key areas of focus is on physical inactivity. Physical inactivity and unhealthy eating combined are the second leading cause of preventable death and disease in our state. Right now, more than 60% of Minnesotans are either overweight or obese, and about 13% of high school students are obese across the country. Right now, unfortunately, Minnesota ranks 21st in the nation in its obesity rate, and like almost all other states, we're getting heavier each year. This matters because obesity increases the risk for many diseases such as heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, and all of these diseases greatly strain our healthcare system. If current trends continue, only one-third of Minnesota adults will be at a healthy weight by 2010, this next year, and one-quarter will be obese. And if we jump to the year 2020, we will see that reverse, where we'll see less than a quarter of Minnesotans at a healthy weight and 31% obese. We've also shown that 31% of the overall health increases, the overall increases in healthcare costs between now and the year 2020 will be due to a single factor. So nearly a third of the increases in healthcare costs due to a single factor, and that factor is weight. These increases will add nearly $1 billion to Minnesota's total annual health care spend by 2010 and $3.7 billion by the year 2020. We've put these figures and analysis into a report called Obesity and Future Health Care Costs, and I believe you have a copy of that that's been handed out to you. And you've got the executive summary. I should note that all the numbers I've mentioned that are in the report are conservative. They cover only health care costs. They say nothing about long-term care costs or lost productivity, but even so, these very conservative numbers are quite disturbing. I don't have to say it, that obesity is a serious health problem facing Minnesota, and it affects all of us because we all pay for health care costs. But the good news in this is that this can be prevented, and if we achieve even a modest success at controlling obesity, it will help control future health care costs and improve health. Unfortunately, willpower won't do this alone. Right now, many factors are leading to obesity, and factors in our communities and in our schools, and we need to look for every opportunity to make a difference and make regular activity the easy, normal choice for Minnesotans, kids included. So, Mr. Chair and members, if we're serious about health care reform and containing health care costs, we really can't afford to ignore the human and economic toll that inactivity and obesity take on the quality of life and our healthcare system. tackling the childhood obesity epidemic is going to require multiple strategies, including this kind of policy, so we make it easy for kids to be active. I urge you to make solving obesity a priority today by supporting this policy, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Representative Norton, do you have any other testifiers on your behalf? Is that a no?
Mr. Chair, we have other people who would love to talk if you want to hear them, but I think we've covered our territory.
Thank you. This is a public hearing. Any members of the audience wish you to testify for or against the legislation? Welcome.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kirk Seidel, staff of the Minnesota School Board Association, and we've worked with Representative Norton very closely on a number of issues and have a great working relationship with her, and I think it's one of the issues that I think that it's important for you to know from a school district perspective that this is not an issue that's being brought forward by the collective school boards or school districts around the state. This is an American Heart Association bill, so just consider that piece. School districts presently are required to have locally developed standards. So to bring FIED back is not a true statement because we do have locally developed standards. We do have school districts doing these at the elementary level, the junior high level, at the high school level. And we understand the importance of the social, emotional, and academic connections that involve themselves with physical activity. And school districts understand that. And you heard from your testifiers today about the local efforts that they have done. So the question is, will North State standards change what they're doing today? I'm not sure about that. It's also important to understand that implementing new standards is not a free thing that's going to be free for school districts. There will be administrative time, there will be teacher time for implementation of these standards, there will be new curriculum materials, there will be potentially new equipment in the FIED area. And my guess is that these elementary standards will require more time at the elementary level. And the question is for local school boards, when it gets right down to it, if these standards are going to require more time for schools, at what are we going to sacrifice potentially? So that's something that needs to be considered as well. The reality is, and the elephant in the room is, the districts are measured on reading, writing, science, and their language arts skills. And it's unfortunate that we've gone down this track about measuring districts on all the academic areas. It's an important piece for us to grow as well, but that's where districts change. I mean, they focus their efforts on these areas because of the policies that state and federal governments have made. And so as a result of that, we've seen some contraction, but not elimination of FIED in Minnesota. And then I think lastly, I would just want to point out, at a time when we're looking at a huge state deficit, I think it's important for you to understand that potentially the costs that go along with adding new standards in the K-8 and the K-12 FIED program could bring to school districts. And so I'll stand for any questions that you may have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Again, this is a public hearing. Anyone else who would testify either for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, I'll be pretty brief here. As the author of this bill for the last 2 years, and prior to that it was a bill that had been worked on members for 2 years prior to that and passed in the Senate. Also, I just want to make sure members know that. And I respect Mr. Suderman's remarks as well. I carried this bill the last 2 years because Mr. Orwell, comments were very, very wrong. And everyone who testified wrote out the statistics that we all know about chronic disease and diabetes and obesity. But it was all about, you want to pay me now or do you want to pay me later? Because when we start removing FIED from the schools, we have already started to see significant ramifications from that. And the other thing I want members to remember is what we're trying to instill here is we're not trying to just instill good habits for math and science and language arts and social. We're also trying to instill habits, lifelong habits of nutrition and wellness and good characteristics that will make a well-rounded, physically, emotionally,
student and human being, so I just want to make sure that, you know, we talked about that as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Ward. Members, we have five members who wish to make statements or ask questions, and we are going to adjourn at 4:15. So, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm a believer in physical education. I am concerned about what appears to be the mandate issue of this bill. But I do have a specific question on page 3 of the bill, lines 28 through 33, about participation in another learning opportunity. Is this going to exempt the football player or the young fellow that does Taekwondo on Monday night? How is that addressed in that portion of the bill?
Representative Norton.
Thank you for the question. That was actually Representative Abler's amendment to my bill in the last committee. It does give local school districts the authority to set their own rules about exempting students who might participate in a variety of athletics if they can prove that they've met the standards. And so that's left to the local districts. It just gives them the authority to do that.
Representative Biskin.
And it says May, I'm sorry. May exempt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that was one of the questions that I had, and Representative Norton, I do appreciate your response. I've never been a supporter of this bill, but I was looking for ways in which I may be able to, and this was a person who has a fire teaching certification, and so I wonder if some more clarity on lines 3.31. I'm not going to make the amendment now, but I know this bill will have a long time before it's ever passed in the omnibus bill, but if after the board's opportunity you wouldn't consider explicitly stating including a co-curricular athletic activity as being one of those opportunities. However, Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, I think that exemption that's on page 3, lines 28 through 33, is actually a shadow exemption and one that couldn't possibly exist because the opportunities would have to meet or exceed the physical education standards required. And if I go back to page 2, lines 1 through 10, or actually 4 through 10, you make those standards consistent with national standards, and I don't know what the national standards are, but I don't see how participation in wrestling, right, is ever going to meet those national standards. And I guess I'd like to see that. Otherwise, that whole section's a moot point. I do want to ask the question, and Representative Norton, maybe you don't know the answer to this, and maybe we can defer to Ms. Larson, right? But are there any other state standards, subject area state standards, where we actually defer to a national organization to set our standards? Does that happen in math and science? Or can the state adopt them without statutorily telling the state you have to adopt these national standards?
Representative Norton.
And if I could defer to one of my presenters, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Orwell. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Concerning your comments about whether or not it would, let's say, a team sport or an individual sport might meet one of the six national standards set forth by NASSB, one of them is valuing lifelong physical activity. Another one is participation. So there are two that would meet that directly. A third one would be achieving appropriate fitness standards. So all of those things could very easily contribute to a student meeting that particular standard set by the national organization. There are others that don't specifically apply to your particular concern. One of the things, I guess personally, I don't know if this is the right time to interject it, but I would love to see students involved in physical education regardless of their participation in extracurricular athletics. You know, I tend to view exercise or activity in the same manner in which I view eating, and that is that it's necessary, but you can't take it all at once. You need to spread it out and pace yourself with it. So if I took all my meals on Sunday and didn't eat the rest of the week, that would not be a health benefit. And so what I guess what we're trying to do is really encourage our students in this state to be, to have the habit of physical activity, and certainly they do during the season, but I really would love to see it be broader than that.
Representative Poyles.
Mr. Chair, I'm not concluded.
Actually, we got other people.
Real good about talking about
Representative Poyles. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We really should be fully vetting these bills, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Representative Wells.
On page 2, line 2, I think there's some problems with the language, the Quality Teaching Network. As I understand that, that is, I was a part of the Best Practices Teaching Network a few years ago, and I believe they have changed their name to the Quality Teaching Network. But it's unusual to have something in a bill that names a group in statute that is not organized via statute, if I am correct. Is that, Ms. Larson, is that?
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chairman, members, to the extent that we don't know what Quality Teaching Network is and we're basing standards for graduation on that entity, it may be helpful to clarify more precisely what it is and or what those standards are, because they are not it's not currently recognized, and consequently it would be difficult to fix the precise standard without the some ability to precisely recognize that entity.
Ms. Larson, then, is there some specific language, or would you say omit that phrase to make the bill more clear?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Swales, if your intent is to retain the benchmarks, my suggestion, or one suggestion, might be to specify precisely what they are so that there would be no question about
it. Right. Maybe for future consideration, if the author would do that, I think it would make the bill much more explicit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will certainly consider that. I know this language that was chosen on line 2.2 was with the help of the department. So, but I will confer with them again.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment. Like Representative Anderson, I'm a believer in physical activity for kids. I was never an athlete myself, but my 17 years in the classroom and some good FIAD teachers convinced me of that. That and the 8-year-old athlete I have at home, who alternates, her favorite class is either SciEd or math, depending on the week. I am, however, also a believer in irony, and I appreciate the irony of this bill that this committee has a subcommittee chaired by Representative Tilbury on mandate reduction, and here we're considering a mandate, an unfunded mandate on our schools, at a time, since I also believe in reality, that they're going to get few, if any, new dollars. And here we're going to put more expectations on them with no resources to achieve those expectations. And so I'm concerned that if we increase FIAD, do a good thing by increasing FIAD, Representative Ward wants kids to come out whole, well-rounded, we'll be working against that, because something's got to give. Is it art? Is it music? Is it school counselors? I'm waiting for the time that we get the report of the school that had to eliminate recess in order to accommodate this new unfunded mandate.
Representative Martin.
Mr. Chair, looking at the clock, I'll gladly pass so that you can adjourn the meeting if that is your intent.
Thank you. Representative Martin, any final comments?
Well, I do want to end, I don't want to end without having addressed Mr. Dabney's comments. I don't see this as a mandate. I see it as adding a requirement, just like we do for reading, math, science, and all the others, and we didn't call reading a mandate. We called it a graduation standard and a requirement. So I would also like to say that there will be funds available because we adopt statewide standards. In fact, we have a list of $7 million that has been accumulated in various districts, including some, St. Paul, Brainerd, Duluth, a number of districts, because they adopted the statewide standards. And also, as I mentioned earlier in testimony, there's also funding available to help districts through the SHIP grant. And so I think this is not an unfunded mandate. I think it's a requirement. There's no state cost, and most districts already meet this requirement. There are just a couple who may have a tiny bit of additional cost, and maybe these grants will be available to them.
Representative Jettner renews his motion to have House File 439 laid over for possible inclusion in the K-12 finance bill. Thank you. And Representative Ward, you had an announcement.
One announcement, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and thank you for chairing the meeting today. And as a requirement to do that, you have to sign on to House File number 2. I just want to make sure that you understood that. On Tuesday, members, we'll be having HF 935. It's Representative Slocum's charter bill before us. And this committee has a 24-hour amendment rule. So if the first endorsement is on the House website for you to review, so if anybody needs to get an amendment drafted, we have the 24-hour rule for amendments. So if you need to get something drafted, make sure you do that in a timely fashion, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
With that, the committee is adjourned. Thank you.